Foothills and Beyond. Up next, Ecotopia.
Have I been sleeping? I've been so still, afraid of crumbling. Have I been careless? Dismissing all the distant rumblings. Take me where I am supposed to be, to comprehend the things that I can't see. 'Cause I need to move. And as a child, I danced like it was 1999. My dreams were wild. The promise of this new world would be mine. Now I am throwing off the carelessness of youth to listen to an inconvenient truth that I need to move, I need to wake up, I need to change, I need to shake up, I need to speak out. Something's got to break up. I've been asleep and I need to
was Melissa Etheridge, and that was the theme song from An Inconvenient Troop, I Need to Wake Up. This is Susan Chudy, and you are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico. We are a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Steve Chudy is away tonight, and tonight we are continuing our series of radical change shows, and the program tonight we'll be talking with Dr. Claire Brown. She's a professor of economics and director of the Center for Work, Technology, and Society at the University of California in Berkeley. She's part of our series on radical change, and she's an advocate of a Buddhist economy, a holistic economic approach where the economy delivers a high quality of life in a sustainable world. Buddhist economics integrate sustainability, equity, and compassion. And she is the author of Buddhist Economics, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science, and that was published in 2017. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Corona Conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets. With year-round markets on Wednesday mornings at the North Valley Plaza and on Saturday mornings at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico, the Chico Certified Farmers Market, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. The opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back to talk with Claire Brown about Buddhist economics.
Don't worry, Mother, it'll be all right. Don't worry, Sister, say your prayers and sleep tight. It'll be fine, lover of mine. Be just fine. Lend your voices only to sounds of freedom. No longer lend your strength to that which you wish to be free from. Feel lies with love and bravery, and you shall. I've heard your anguish, I've heard your heart's cry out. We are tired, we are weary, but we aren't worn out. Set down your chains till only faith remains. Set down.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and my guest tonight is Dr. Claire Brown, who will be talking with us about Buddhist economics. Lest you think that Claire Brown is some loosey-goosey, hippy-dippy liberal, we want to give you a fulsome account of her work as an economist. Dr. Claire Brown is a professor of economics and director of the Center for Work, Technology, and Society at the University of California, Berkeley. She is a past director of the Institute of Institutional Relations at UC Berkeley. She has published research on many aspects of how economies function, including high-tech industries, development engineering, the standard of living, wage determination, poverty, and unemployment. Her books include American Standards of Living, 1919 to 1988, and Chips and Change, How Crisis Reshapes the Semiconductor Industry. Claire's contributions to the field of labor economics were recognized by the Labor and Employment Relations Association, who awarded her their Lifetime Achievement Award in 2010. Claire's Economic Approach and Life as an Economist is published in Eminent Economist 2, Their Life and Work Philosophies, and that's by Cambridge. Welcome, Claire Brown. Whew.
Oh, I'm so happy to join you, Susan, on Ecotopia. So thanks for inviting me.
Yes, it's great to have you here. I've been looking forward to this. Claire, when we first corresponded, you said you'd like to start by talking about what makes life meaningful and then move into a discussion of economics and specifically Buddhist economics. But I'd like to start with a big overarching question that will touch on everything. Then we'll come back to talk about what makes life meaningful, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about that as you answer this question. You're a feminist, a Buddhist, a wife, a mother, a professor, a mentor, an author, a philosopher, an economist. How has that complex identity shaped the way you've developed your economic theory and life's work?
That's a really wonderful way to start. So thank you for having me think about sort of where did I come and how did I get here? Because I've been really fortunate to have many wonderful, amazing people mentor and teach me. And certainly they've helped shape my identity and worldview, which I apply in my economics. But one person stands out, and I hold my memories of her in my heart because she really taught me about racism in a really loving way. And this was my black nanny, Nazarene, who cared for me from the day I was born until I was in the fourth grade. She was like a mom to me. And this was in Tampa, Florida, when I lived in a totally segregated society. And it was totally dominated by whites, with blacks put in a really inferior place. And as they helped us, they served us. But I was really lucky because here I was, this little kid growing up. And Nazarene and I had a really close relationship. And she taught me about the things that I looked around, and I kept being so inquisitive about, Nazarene, I just saw the most amazing movie, Alice in Wonderland, in 1951. You have to go see it. And she explained to me why she couldn't go see it, because she wasn't allowed in a theater I went to. It was whites only, and the black theater didn't get any good movies. And then she explained to me about why we had to drink out of different water fountains at the grocery store, white and black. And then she explained to me why I'd ask her, Nazarene, why do you always get on and ride in the back of the bus? And she would explain to me that's where they made her ride. And even as a little kid, I could see that this was crazy and outrageous. Here was this woman who was the center of my life, and she wasn't being treated well, because it was very clear, she would explain to me the impact it had on her life to be black and to be treated as an inferior person. And that, I think, is why I became an economist. I really wanted to help make the world a better place. And in my dissertation, I focused on discrimination in the labor market, both for women but also for blacks. And so I'm really grateful because of Nazarene, who got me off in a way that made me look at the world critically and ask, why are certain people treated the way they are by the color of their skin or by the way they speak or by their religion or whatever? And that's one of the things that drove me to be an economist, that cared about discrimination and racism.
I mean, it's just so odd that you were given into the care of a person who was considered inferior, and this person gave you the love and support that you really needed as a small child, but they're considered in, I've never been able to get over that irony. I just think it's so bizarre.
Yes, it really is. But then all of racism and racial injustice makes no sense.
It's crazy. So let's go back to where we were going to start at one point when we were conversing. What does make life meaningful? And why do you think there's so much disagreement about what makes life meaningful?
Well, there's certainly disagreement in the United States now. I'm not so sure there is in other parts of the world, but people in the U.S. are so polarized based upon their different values and worldview. And it's highly unfortunate that we're so polarized even about what makes life meaningful. So there's one group who's just completely bought into the free market view of life. It's egotistical. Freedom for individuals is most important for them to be able to do what they please. And their meaningful life is based upon money, getting more money, having more status consumption, having more power over people and nature. But the other group, of which I'm a part and you're a part, we understand the interdependence of people with each other and with nature. And so that means we care about people as well as we care for ourselves. So, but we care about people and ourselves. And a meaningful life for us, and your, hopefully most of your listeners, I hope, but thanks to them for joining us.
I'm guessing that this
really
is true.
Really revolves around relationships and helping other people, contributing to the community, caring for nature. Basically, a meaningful life for us is enjoying life while we live in harmony with each other and the planet. Those are two really different ways of thinking about life and what makes it meaningful.
You said that this is true particularly in the United States, and I know you've done a lot of work internationally. How would you compare various places that you've observed and studied, regions and countries, and how would you compare the U.S.'s notion of what is meaningful to what you've seen in other places?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question. I don't want to respond with too broad a brush because, mm-hmm. of course, cultures vary around the world, and there's a lot of nuance even in a region or one country. But you do see some variation that, you know, has patterns. And so, for example, when you go to Asia, they definitely approach life in a more spiritual way, and they really do want to care for the human spirit. They realize their interdependence with others, and that requires caring for others. And then you go to Western Europe, and they really understand the importance and value of social cohesion and having a society that takes care of everyone, and people are truly seen as equal. And these are two ways that culture helps people to think about what makes life meaningful. I haven't been to any country that puts so much value on so-called personal freedom. Each person gets to do whatever they want to do and won't have to be told by anyone what to do. Where the free market is seen as, you know, the way to go with get rid of government. I don't see that in any other country. You can see some variations of it, but it's really powerful and observed in the U.S. by many people.
And the mask situation in the past few weeks has really made that clear, how people say, I'm free to do whatever I want. And so there is no attention to the needs of others. I was kind of rude when I walked into a bank the other day and the clerks weren't wearing masks, and I said, you know, if I got COVID, I could die. And they kind of, you know, looked away from me. But really no concern about the older people that are around them, the unhealthier people that are around them. There was a very old man, and he and I were the only two in the place who had masks. And I was thinking, the rest of you are not attending to anything but your own, I get to do what I want to do.
Oh, and the bank should have required it.
You know, I think I'm going to call them and say...
Yeah, that, because it's up to them to tell their employees, you have to wear masks for the health of our clients and customers, please.
Yeah.
Oh. But, you know, also I'll get emails from my European friends or Asian friends, and they're all absolutely unbelieving that Americans won't wear masks.
Right.
They're used to it. They're happy to. They couldn't imagine not doing it. And so the rest of the world is really finding the U.S. hard to understand. And right now, as you know, the U.S. has the most rampant COVID contagion and cases. And it's like we're leading the world in how not to handle the COVID contagion. It's a problem. It's a big national problem right now.
And it gets to that issue of social cohesion and care for others.
Yes.
How have we gotten here? Was the United States, I won't ask, was the United States always like this, but what have been some of the socio-political factors that have influenced our views and what makes life meaningful, especially since the 80s and the Reagan era?
Yes. Reagan's presidency was a big turning point for the United States, and Margaret Thatcher in the UK at the same time,
yes,
it was a big turning point for them,
mm-hmm,
in terms of saying, you know what, we don't need so much government. We want to rethink the role of government. And so Reagan, I remember this so well because it actually was when I was writing my American Standards of Living book. And I was so surprised to hear Reagan say, listen, we have a great social safety net that takes care of all the people in need, so we don't have to worry about that. We really don't. It's okay for us to not worry about the income distribution because people in need or vulnerable people, they'll have a safety net. So now we can actually all just get as much income as we can, not worry about inequality, and we're going to really lower taxes. But that really meant we had a very progressive tax system when Reagan came in. It had high tax rates at the top of like 65-70%. And he said, we're going to really get rid of our progressive tax system because everybody should get to be in charge of how they spend their own money. And we don't have to worry about people in poverty. Remember, we have a safety net, which was not true. And so, but people believed it. He was a very convincing and likable president. And so he convinced the U.S. that everybody, you can now focus on your own income, make as much money as you can, make as much wealth as you can. It's all okay to have status consumption and show off who you are and sort of how much money you make. It totally changed the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we did that, then GDP, or national income, became the national goal.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't matter how it was distributed. And that was a huge turning point for the way the U.S. thought in terms of culture and inequality. Poverty rates went up. Inequality has skyrocketed for four generations after that. Our social programs have really been decimated. The social safety net, as we found out with the COVID crisis, doesn't really exist. We had to recreate it. It started with Reagan, but it continued through. It wasn't all Reagan's fault by any means. It's like it became the national culture. Oh, make all the money you can, get all the wealth you can. Unfortunately, it really, this focus on the free market and materialistic economy had people chasing after more and more income.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, when there's a lot of inequality, there's what economists call the relative income effect, which means everybody sort of judges their income by what it is relative to the people above them.
Mm-hmm.
And so people started feeling much worse off as they saw the people living luxurious lives at the top of the income distribution. And so even if their income didn't go down, their relative income fell with inequality,
yes.
And they started feeling worse off. And so then they were less satisfied with their lives and their incomes. So then they started chasing after more and more income and consumption, thinking that this was the way to be happy. But you and I know that's not true. So we ended up chasing after income and goods and feeling worse off. And that's pretty much where we end up today.
I have a Buddhist teacher who talks about grasping, and how that grasping can become an endless cycle. If I just had an electric car, then I'd be happy. Or if I just could get a job at a slightly bigger department store, then I'd be happy. Or if I just had a slightly better neighborhood, I'd be happy. Then I'd be happy when we get this next thing, means that then there's another thing that we have to wait for that's going to make us happy. And it just keeps going on and on and on. How do we get off this cycle of desire and discontent?
Oh, you just put it so well, Susan. That's exactly how the Dalai Lama teaches us. It says, you know, we're just going to keep chasing after the next thing. And when you think a specific good or a specific outcome is going to make you happy, then actually you're going to always be suffering, because there's never a way to end the list. The list is endless.
Right.
And how do we stop? Well, that's actually the question that pushed me to write my book, Buddhist Economics. And so that leads me to ask, I just hope all your listeners will take some time during this period of social isolation to ask, what makes my life meaningful? Because once we have the time to think that, then that allows us to hop off the treadmill and think, what does make my life meaningful? Oh, did a new car? No. Did adding on to my house, painting my house, a retirement plan, did that make me happy? Well, yeah, it might have made me happy for a day or two, but then I just reverted back to my old grasping or longing for more things or another thing to make life more exciting. So once we start thinking about what really makes my life meaningful, when you ask people what makes their life meaningful, they never talk about consumption. They talk, again, about family, about relationships, about something they did that was really a great experience with other people or their families. They talk about doing something that felt rewarding when they helped someone or when they made a contribution to an event in their community or their schools. They talk about that. Oh, when I helped the PTA put on this event and we raised money, I felt so good about that. And so basically, when we sit back and ask, we don't come up with chasing after more income and consumption. We actually end up talking about the people we care about, the events we have in our lives, the way we help others. Then you come back and say, oh, well, just a minute. Now that I'm really thinking about how I want to live, what do I want to do post-COVID? Because this crisis is allowing us to rethink how we're living and is requiring our society to rethink how we're going to live as a society. And so we really do want to think about socially also, what do we need for us to all be able to hop off the treadmill and live a more meaningful life? And so we really do need to have an economy that lets everyone live comfortably, and that we need to have, everyone needs some health care, a true social safety net during hard times. We need the opportunity to develop our full potential. We want our kids to develop their full potential. And we want to have ways that we can care for other people, and we certainly want to help care for the planet and enjoy nature. So one of the things I do And to do that means we're all going to have to work together to make that happen. So one of the things I do to make my life have meaning is I work with my local 350 group on California legislation that develops climate policies to stop carbon emissions. Because we want California to show the rest of the world how to transition to a clean energy, modern economy. We know how to stop greenhouse gas emissions. We know how to heal the planetary ecosystems. This climate scientists have taught us all of that. We just have to do it. And so this political work really, with others, gives a lot of meaning to my life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one way that all of us will find meaning in our lives, both working personally, but with others.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and I'm talking with Claire Brown. She's a professor of economics at UC Berkeley and author of Buddhist Economics, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science. We'll take a short break and come back and talk about how a meaningful life translates into an economy, as she just said, that works for everyone.
Don't worry, Mother. Thank you.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and I'm talking with Dr. Claire Brown. She's a professor of economics and director of the Center for Work, Technology, and Society at UC Berkeley. And we're talking about the subject of her 2017 book, Buddhist Economics, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science. Why did you decide to entitle your book? I'm interested both in the Buddhist economics part and in the dismal science part.
Oh, well, it's sort of a sad story, I think, Susan. Buddhist economics was the name of my undergraduate seminar that I started teaching at Berkeley in spring 2013, 8 years ago now. I've taught it 8 times. As a practicing Buddhist, I wanted to develop an economic framework that was based on 3 assumptions that every Buddhist would think, of course: interdependence of people with each other and the planet, that people are altruistic and compassionate, and that we care for the human spirit as well as the body and mind. This seminar became the basis for my book, and Bloomsbury Press, the publisher, thought that the name Buddhist Economics, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science, was a great name, so they named it that. And it sort of reflected the culture at the time. You remember, Obama was president, and people really were feeling much more aware of how we were treating each other. And people were much, much less aggressive and much kinder in those days, if you can think back to then. I know in my classes I saw that and felt that, as well as in my climate work. Well, unfortunately, the timing was terrible for when my book was going to come out. They thought my book would come out after Hillary Clinton was made the first woman president, and that people would really be ready for this kind of thinking. Alas, Trump was elected. He took office a month before the release of my book. Everything in the country had changed. Buddhist economics turned out to be an awful name. It turned the press off. They'd say, "I don't cover religion."
Oh,
it also
goodness.
Turned off a lot of readers. They said, "Oh, I'm not religious." Well, actually, as a Buddhist, I actually don't think of myself as religious either. I think of it more as philosophical approach
it's
to an
boss.
Ethical way
yes.
of living.
Yes.
Anyway, I really wish we had chosen a different release date and also a different title. Everybody thinks economics is the dismal science. That was no problem. I mean, you know, I just laugh when I'm going to talk to people about economics. I say, "I'm an economist. I know. Don't leave quite yet. Just give me a chance." Because economics actually does have a lot to say about how the world works and how we can make it work better. But it is the dismal science in that the way it got that name is that It was a big joke that whenever the economy is doing well and heating up is when the Federal Reserve, the bankers, come in and remove the punch bowl. They take away the punch bowl, party's over. And so that's how it got this idea that it was a dismal science. It was always no fun for anybody except economists.
What is Buddhist economics, and how does it differ? You've given us a little bit about the philosophical points that underlie it. How does it differ from traditional neoliberal economics?
So that's at the heart of the question of why did I do Buddhist economics? So I was teaching Econ 1, and Econ 1 at every school, we teach this free market model mainly because it's real simple to teach, and it's traditionally what we teach. And so we say, "Oh, okay, everybody's selfish. Everybody wants to maximize their own income. Companies want to just maximize profit. That's all they do. And don't worry, we don't have to worry about income distribution because all we have to do is worry about average income. It's okay. The market will take care of everything." And so market has this magical quality of somehow making everything work out that and we're assuming everybody has the same opportunities in the society, that there's no discrimination. Everybody has perfect information. There's no problem with some people having a lot more information than others. We assume that there's actually no what we call externalities or social cost. Hey, if we put out a lot of carbon emissions, don't worry, it's okay. We don't have to pay for it. So people in the economy can dominate nature and not mm-hmm. worry about using nature as if it's freely available to us without any consequences. Well, that's the free market model. And in that model, anything by the government is only going to make interference with the market working its magic. But, of course, the market doesn't work its magic.
Mm-mm.
So we end up with an alternative, whereas if you go in and assume what I just mentioned Buddhists would naturally assume, interdependence of people and the planet, that people are altruistic and not just selfish, and that the human spirit's an important part of who we are, and that, in fact, we are. Our interdependence with the Earth means it does matter what we do to the planetary systems,
mm-hmm.
and that people care a lot more. When you talk about the human spirit, we care a lot more about just chasing more money and goods. So the minute you make those assumptions, you've turned the neoclassical free market model totally on its head,
mm-hmm.
and you get completely different goals. You no longer are maximizing average national income. You're maximizing the well-being of all people and caring for the planet. And you're offering people and supporting a life where consumption is fine as long as everybody has it. But happiness doesn't come more and more and more. More is not always better for consumption. That people really do care about their relationships and their role in the community and sort of how they can give back to the Earth in a way that is meaningful to them. You end up with two diametrically opposed worldviews, the models, the economic models or systems that go with it.
Are there ways that...
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. I'm wondering if you see places in our culture where Buddhist economics are being enacted, or are we on the complete opposite side of that? Or in other cultures, where do you see this way of thinking about things actually being enacted?
That's such a great question. So Susan, when I would go about to give talks about this economics, I kept getting the question of, this just sounds like a pipe dream.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can have a Buddhist economy or Buddhist-like economy anywhere. Like, where do you have a Buddhist kind of economy? I thought, you know, I should be able to answer that with specific data. So I went back and together a student research team at Berkeley, and for the last 2 years, my research team and I have developed what I call a Sustainable Shared Prosperity Policy Index. It's about policies that countries have, because actually we know the policies to reduce inequality and share prosperity. We know the climate scientists have given us all the policies to create a clean, energy-only economy. And we know how to have regenerative agriculture and not industrial agriculture with all of its methane problems and the way it's degrading the soil and so forth. We know how to reduce global suffering. The UN has shown that with their Sustainable Development Goals. And great job in helping to reduce global poverty and starvation, to educate women and girls. The COVID crisis is interfering with some of that, but we know how to do these things. We have policies. So my research group went out and collected data on policies in 50 countries, mostly European, U.S., OECD. And so we have this SSPI, Sustainable Shared Prosperity Policy. So we know the countries actually have a food-style economy. And no one calls it that. Most people call it social democracy. So we have Sweden, Denmark, Finland,
Claire,
France, Austria, Germany, Norway. Those all rank really well on the SSPI, okay. Along with Australia and Canada. Guess where the U.S. is?
Yeah, not good.
There were 36 out of 50 countries. It's pretty big. So you see that culturally, we're way behind these other countries in the kind of economy we've created and our policies. Though, and this is the one thing that troubles me a lot, is every single country needs to do better with their policy around carbon emissions, around waste management, there's a lot of wasteful consumption, around agriculture, care of the soil. So every country needs to do better on sustainability and protecting the Earth ecosystem. Even though these countries, I think they're all doing great on programs and restructuring markets and really helping the quality of life in terms of human well-being.
You've been breaking up for a couple seconds here, for a couple minutes here, and I'm going to try hanging up and calling you back. We only have about 4 or 5 more minutes, but I want to make sure that you're clear. So could we hang up?
Oh,
and
are we having phone problems?
You're breaking up a little bit. It's
So yeah, I can hear it. Do you want to try me on my other phone then?
Okay, I'll try you on your other phone. So we'll take a short break be back with Claire in just a minute. Okay. Claire, do we have you? Oh, boy. Just a sec. Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, good. Super. Okay, we were in the middle of talking about the environmental disasters of not having a caring economy, a Buddhist economy that cares for the earth. And one of the things I want you to repeat is what when you and your research assistants looked at countries around the world, you were looking at, what was the acronym for what you called a caring economy?
I called it the Sustainable Shared Prosperity Policy Index.
Okay.
So it's the policies that countries have, not the outcomes, but just their policies. That would create a sustainable economy that has equity and cares for people and gives and helps support meaningful lives for everyone. And that's called, I call that the SSPI.
SSPI. And could you repeat where the United States fell again, even though it's kind of horrible?
Okay.
To hear?
Well, I appreciate the patience and of your listeners, so thank you. Yeah, so Sweden, Denmark, Finland were at the top. And along with France and Germany did quite well. The U.S. ranked 36 out of 50 countries.
And What are the most kind of glaring areas where the United States is failing?
Well, to be 36,
pretty much everything.
you could do better across the board. Absolutely. And so I can't just say, oh, if the U.S. just did this or this mm-hmm. or this, they basically need to do a lot better in providing government programs that has a great, strong social safety net. They really do need to do a whole lot better on carbon emissions and wasteful consumption. And they definitely need to do better on their agricultural policies that are degrading the water supplies and the soil. And so we have a lot of ways that we can do much better, which is actually, that's the good news. Uh-huh. The United States, we know the policies, and together as citizens, we can really come together to push for the changes that we know we need to make as a country.
For
sustainability and for equity.
Can we push companies and corporations and, as well as the government? Should citizens be lobbying business as well as government?
Yes, there are two ways that we should push our companies. And one is we should demand green products. Companies listen to what their customers want. We do know that. So mm-hmm. when you demand green products, or when you say, I don't want to buy this, it's got toxins in it, it's got things in it that aren't good for me or for the earth, companies listen to that. The other one's a little bit harder, because all of us can protest and get together as customers and their organizations that lead the way on that. The other one, though, I find a little bit harder to do, but if you team up with friends at work, you should also start talking to bosses about, you know, we really need paid family leave. We really need paid vacation days. We all need to be able to take time off from work when we need to care for our families. But we can't afford to unless we get some paid time off. And so this is standard policy in other countries. The U.S. is the only country that doesn't have paid right. child care time off. When you have a baby. We're the only country without everyone getting maternity leave and quite a few months of it. So there are lots of ways that we can ask for it, but often it's somewhat easier to go to the government, federal government, and say, you know, we ought to mandate paid time off. We should mandate maternity leave. We should have a minimum amount that every company has to have, because that's what other countries do. And once you mandate it, then, of course, the companies are all going to do it. They could do it now, but they don't, because they don't have to. And so there are certain ways that we can get together and make the demands of companies, because they could do a whole lot better than they are to help us all live more balanced lives and lives that are easier for us to care for our families and for our communities and each other. And we also need to enjoy life. Hey, life's here to enjoy. We aren't working to just work.
Yeah, right.
We really do want to enjoy life.
What are the steps to get us from where we are now to there? Because I can't see that anybody would not, if they understood this, would not see this as the goal. Maybe very rich people who don't want to give up any of their money or something. But how do we, what can we do to move forward?
Well, I think actually the COVID-19 crisis is opening the wedge for us.
Nice.
I already see it happening. People are now coming together and saying, oh my gosh, we need paid sick leave.
Yeah.
We absolutely need paid sick leave. We actually need to figure out how to have better public health care. We need to have better health insurance for everyone, because 5 million people just lost their health insurance when they lost their jobs. So we know that this is a time of crisis. And one of the bright sides of crisis is that it's a time when we're coming back, we're having economic recovery. It's a time to say, hey, we need a green economic recovery. It's also a time to say it's time to look at the social safety net again
mm-hmm.
and make sure that it functions when people are in need and we need it. It's a time that we're all stuck, And we're all going to become more engaged, I think, in what's happening in the government. And we're all going to hopefully start making demands with our governments of this and companies. This is what we need. And this is what we know can be done. We know the policies. Let's do them. And we have a vision of the world we want. Mm-hmm. Together we can create it. Mm-hmm. All we need is the courage. Courage to work with others, to demand the changes. We also need the courage to enjoy life during this period of crisis.
Mm-hmm. How can people learn more about you and your work? And how can they become part of this progress toward a Buddhist economy?
Oh, I would just love to have them go online. BuddhistEconomics.net. That's my website.
What is it? BuddhistEconomics.net, correct?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good.
BuddhistEconomics, one word, .net.
Okay.
And you can learn a lot more about this. There's lots of information there with blogs and, hey, with podcasts and interviews and ideas about how you can move forward. So just remember that when you get in, find a group and get involved with creating the change, the vision you have of what's important to you, you only have to have one thing that you really would like to work on and to help change. Because there are lots of people out there, and they all have synergy together. One of the things I love about my work with 350 is, hey, I know economics. I can bring in economics. Everybody has a skill and talent that they can contribute. And they just have to find a group that they like working with and then think, here's what I'd really like to work on. And here's how I'd like to add value to the world and help the world. And they can do it that way, which is really, really helpful to the world, but also to them. It's a true win-win. And so I think that's really important, to think about it on a personal level, but then get engaged at a societal level. Because the world and the society need us all right now.
Right. And we have a lot of organizations in Chico who are working on all of the things that you just talked about, healthcare, climate change. We have a great 350 group. So absolutely, we can do that. Thank you so much. Our guest has been Dr. Claire Brown. She's a professor of economics and director of the Center for Work, Technology, and Society at UC Berkeley. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciate your time.
It was terrific. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Uh-huh. Coming up in just a minute, you will be listening to Ginger Nichols, because she's going to bring you lots of music. And she's here all masked up. As soon as I leave, she can take her mask off. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico. As you may know, we're doing a series of radical change shows. Our interview with Claire Brown was about Buddhist economics, and it was suggested by a listener and a friend, Ann Ponzio. If you have suggestions for proponents of radical change you think we should interview, please contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Thanks for joining us. Oh. Thank you.